southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.
During the Jim Crow period, you could not find an area that was more segregated than Forsyth County in Georgia. Two criminal cases ignited the divide even further when violent mobs known as Night Riders drove all 1,100 black residents out of the county. In his book, Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America, Patrick Phillips writes about how these tragic events in 1912 shaped the county that he would later grow up in as a child. His book is published by W.W. Norton. I'm very pleased it has brought Patrick Phillips to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
Was Forsyth County called the white man's county?
It was the most notorious white, you know, quote-unquote white county in Georgia when I was growing up there in the 1970s and 80s.
And that's all that was given that name after all the black residents were driven out in 1912?
Yeah, that's right. In 1912, there was a real season of terror in the fall, September and October of 1912, and following the murder of a young white girl named May Crow, who was 18 years old. She was found beaten and bloody in the woods, not very far from the house where I grew up. And in the wake of her, she died a few weeks later, and in the wake of her death, there were waves of terror and night riding. And over the course of those 2 months, all 1,098 members of the black community were run out. And what's really unique about Forsyth is this held for 80 years. And so on into my childhood there in the 70s and 80s, it was still, quote unquote, all white.
Why did your parents move there? What, they moved in 1977?
They moved in 1977. And they moved there along with a lot of other people who were young professionals in Atlanta. They had just built, the state of Georgia had just extended the interstate highway system. And that really transformed Forsyth from being this backwater that was a long way from Atlanta in terms of travel to suddenly being commutable. And those were the very early days of it becoming a bedroom community of Atlanta.
Now, you've published a few volumes of poetry. Have you ever written poems about Forsyth?
I hadn't written about Forsyth. I'd written one poem that stood out in one of my early books about race, which was a memory of my grandfather saying really kind of virulently racist things in a way that shocked me when I was a child and was the first moment of realizing that some of this real pathology surrounding race extended into my own family.
Were you a bit embarrassed about some of that?
You know, I was steeped in it when I was a kid. My parents are from Birmingham, Alabama, so they grew up in 1950s Birmingham, which most people have an image of what that was like. And there was a real rift in their families surrounding race. So they became civil rights activists and you know, were on the side of integration. And that was a change from their parents. So it was an issue that was constantly in the air.
And when you were growing up, did you hear about the May Crow and Ellen Grice murders?
I had never heard the name Ellen Grice until I started doing the research. She was a woman who a week before May Crow was found, alleged, she said that she had, quote, awakened and found a Negro man in her bed. And this was really the beginning of the wave of paranoia and hysteria. But the story of the racial cleansing was something that I heard in totally mythic, kind of legendary terms from kids on the school bus. You know, they used to say that a long, long time ago, there was this white girl who was killed, and as a result, all the white people banded together and ran out the blacks.
Was it possible that Ellen Grice had willingly had sex with this black man, and then when caught, did what probably would have saved her reputation at the time, say that she was raped?
You know, there's no way to know exactly what happened. That is what you just said is it precisely what Ida B. Wells was floating this hypothesis back in the 19th century, and she called it the old threadbare lie, she said, is that lynchings begin with black men raping white women. And she said that it was widely known in a lot of places in the black community that many of these allegations came from white women who were attracted to young black men. So it certainly seems like a possibility, yeah.
Getting back to May Crow, you say she was a teenager and she was murdered. Who was arrested for the crime?
there were three young black men were arrested for the crime, and they were really...
And a
woman named Jane Daniel. The three young men were really among the only young black men in the area, so it seems that the evidence was largely circumstantial. And they were poor sharecroppers. One of them was a 24-year-old man named Rob Edwards, who was a field hand. And right within 24 hours of his arrest, he was dragged from the county jail, beaten with crowbars, dragged around the town square, and hung from a telephone pole. And then hundreds of people in the white community shot and fired pistols and shotguns into his body. So his lynching became not just a small lynch party, but really like a communal killing.
And lynchings were a form of entertainment in many cases.
This certainly had the air of that. And then the two boys named Ernest Knox, who was 16, and Oscar Daniel, his cousin, who was 18, they were arrested and eventually tried in a one-day trial. And the trial was presided over by a guy named Newt Morris, who would later lead the lynching of Leo Frank in 1915. The sheriff of the county was a future Klansman. Two of the jurors were future Klansmen. So there was what really seems like a kangaroo court trial of these two teenage boys. And then they were hung in a very festival-like atmosphere.
Had there also been an incident in another county that was exacerbating the situation?
Yeah, there was a place called Plainville, Georgia. And Plainville made a lot of headlines in the summer of 1912, the spring and summer of 1912, for what was dubbed a race war. And it originated with two children who were picking peaches in the same orchard, a black child and a white child. So really something incredibly minor swelled up into this clash. And there were a group of men who were about to be lynched on the town square in Plainville, or in the train station in Plainville. And they fought back. And it led to a gunfight. And during the gunfight, the sheriff of that county was killed. And so this led to incredible hysteria among whites that there were, in Forsyth, they believed there was a black insurrection, is what the newspaper said. And there was this incredible fear and paranoia that the black people of the county were going to rise up and take vengeance.
In this case, after the news of Ellen Grice, a mob was created, and Reverend Grant Smith came there to calm the mob down, but the situation only got worse.
Yeah, he was overheard uttering, really, I think, under his breath. The paper said that he was reflecting on the reputation of Ellen Grice.
And he was a black minister?
He was a black minister in his 40s. And really, all he said was that he thought it was too bad that all this trouble was being caused on account of a sorry white woman. And this comment was enough to just, be the spark that lit the powder keg. And all around him, white men used buggy whips and horse whips and started beating him. And he was nearly beaten to death. And he was rescued and taken into the county courthouse. And at that point, the governor deployed state militia troops, to try to calm the mobs.
He was rescued by that sheriff, who was also a Klansman?
Yeah, the sheriff and the deputy, and it's unclear whether the mayor of the town, had any role in this, but the sheriff, Bill Reed, and his deputy, a guy named Gay Loomis, Gay Loomis would later try very hard to stop the lynching of Rob Edwards, but the two of them seem to have rescued Grant Smith, and he was then being protected in the courthouse, and the whole town filled up with soldiers who came to quell all of this unrest.
And he, the minister, wound up leaving town. How did he get away? Because he could have been lynched, too.
Yeah, he was taken to the Fulton Tower, which is the jail in Atlanta. And over again in this story, there are cases of people trying to get accused black people out of the county because there was such a threat of lynching. And I found lots and lots of evidence of prior lynchings in the 19th century. And so Grant Smith was taken to the Fulton Tower and eventually released. And at that point, the black community had already started to disperse and scatter because of all of the night riding. So Grant Smith really just sort of vanishes into the archives. I didn't find any trace of him after he's released.
Didn't the sheriff, Bill Reed, and his deputy, Mitchell Loomis, actually help black people escape?
There's some evidence that Gay Loomis did that. Bill Reed, the sheriff, in fact, abandons his post at the moment of crisis with the lynching. When the lynch mob is outside the jail and about to lynch this man, Rob Edwards, Bill Reed suddenly decides to turn over command of the jail to his deputy, who's a much younger guy and who's also his rival in the county election. And Reed goes home with a mob threatening. And sure enough, they overpowered Gay Loomis and lynched him. And so it seems that Reed was complicit in the lynching. He was later accused of this by the governor. And it seems that Gay Loomis was actually, I was surprised to find, I had always imagined a white community that was unanimous in this. So some of the work of the research complicated my sense of the black community and of the white community.
My guest is Patrick Phillips. His book, Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America. You talked about your research. How well was this story covered by local newspapers? Was it a national story?
It did eventually become a national story. The New York Times reported on it. They reported on a wave of terror in the Georgia foothills, and the epicenter of that really was Forsyth County and the county seat of Cumming. It made a lot of headlines in the Atlanta newspapers and southern regional newspapers. Eventually, that coverage fades away, and you know, at a certain point, a kind of erasure of the event begins, so that some of what I was doing was undoing this amnesia that had set in.
You talked about the lynching of Robert Edwards. He had been taken into jail for as a suspect, but he wasn't tried for the crime.
No, he was lynched by really the entire community within 24 hours, and it's unclear why he was targeted, but there has been a fair amount of work looking at the statistics on lynchings, and a couple of the risk factors when you look at patterns of lynching throughout that era show up in Rob Edwards. One is he was from another place. He was not local there. He had come from South Carolina. And the other is there's an inordinate number of lynching victims are targeted by the mobs who are large men. He was known as Big Rob Edwards. He's a very big man. And this seems to have some significance when you look at the statistics, that they're often going after someone because of his physical size.
We hear that kind of thing even today in some of the cases where black men have been shot by police.
Yeah.
He was large and seen as threatening.
Eric Garner in Staten Island, Michael Brown in Ferguson. I mean, when I saw those reports and I looked at the photographs of them and that these were very large guys, you know, Big Mike, yeah, instantly that resonated with me, thinking about Big Rob in 1912.
What methods did the Knight Riders use to make the black residents leave?
The most effective thing they did was they set fire to black churches.
And did they give them warnings?
No. It's hard to say for sure if they gave them warnings, but this is reported. The very first reports in the newspapers are of black churches being burned. The earliest letters to the governor from the mayor of Cumming mention that five black churches have been set fire to. So it seems that arson and particularly church burning was highly effective. This was the community, the center of the community, the real heart of it.
Where could these people go? Obviously, the neighboring areas would not be any more welcoming.
That's what I thought as well, but I found it was a little more complicated than that, in that a lot of the descendants who I made contact with were living just what was then the Chattahoochee River. There was a dam was built, and now there's a lake there. But in 1912, the two counties, Forsyth and Hall County, were just separated by the Chattahoochee River. And I found that many of these families had resettled just across the county line.
Hall County handled things differently.
Yeah. In Hall County, there was also a wave of terror in 1912. There were also attacks. And it provides an interesting counterexample. The perpetrators were arrested, they were convicted, they were sentenced to jail time, and the local newspapers printed their names. And by contrast, in Forsyth, usually these attacks were reported as the work of persons unknown. And there, I found no evidence of any arrest or conviction of anyone involved.
A lot of land was abandoned as a result of this. Who got it?
It's a complicated question. There were a few different scenarios. There are definitely records of people who sold early during the terror and got out. Often they sold for very depressed prices because they had no choice but to leave. And I think their white neighbors understood their dire situation. Then there are people who held on to the land, perhaps in hope that someday they could come back. But there are also plenty of records of land lots where there was no sale, and yet those lots simply show up again in later transactions, and they seem to have been simply ignored by the county officials.
African Americans weren't the first people who'd had their land taken from them by the county. What happened to Native Americans that had lived there?
Forsyth is also the scene of some of the most significant removal forts during the Cherokee removals in the 1830s. So this became a part of the story I couldn't avoid, because Charlie Harris, the mayor in 1912, his grandfather had participated in the Cherokee removals in the 1830s. So that's really the origin story of the white community in the county. I was always led to, you know, they talk about pioneer ancestors in Forsyth, and it's told in these kind of heroic terms. The reality is Forsyth was settled by white Europeans only after federal troops came and carted the Cherokee to Oklahoma on the Trail of Tears.
So that was President Jackson.
That's correct, yes.
Now, you mentioned the two suspects in the murder, Oscar Daniel and Ernest Knox. They became the two people who were put on trial. And the judge, you said, was a judge who might have a bit of a bias?
Yeah, some people may be familiar with the Leo Frank case. It was the lynching of a Jewish man who was accused again of the rape and murder of a young white girl in 1915. And that case led to the formation of the Anti-Defamation League. It also led to the founding of the Ku Klux Klan, of the second wave Klan, in 1915. So in Atlanta and in the South, the lynching of Leo Frank is a very well-known story. What I didn't know until I got into this research is that the leader of that lynching was a man named Newt Morris. He was also the judge in the trials in Forsyth. So he himself, the judge who presided over the trials of these two boys, would later lead a lynch mob.
What was the trial like? Did anybody come to say something in favor of Oscar Daniel or Ernest Knox?
You know, there's not much evidence that they got any real defense. The defense, the prosecution was a bunch of lawyers who were very experienced and powerful men from Atlanta and Marietta. The defense team was stocked with small town lawyers who were really not experienced with this sort of a case. And the star witness at the trial was Jane Daniel, who was the sister of Oscar, and she was reported to have shocked the entire courtroom by turning state's evidence and testifying against her own brother.
Do we know why she did that?
Well, there are no reports of why she did it. There's a very strong suggestion in the records that she got a visit the night before the trial by the judge and some of the attorneys, and it seems plausible that she was offered some kind of a plea deal and that they convinced her that her brother and cousin were already going to die and that she could save herself by testifying.
And once the sentence was handed down, the state government created a scaffold for Daniel and Knox to be hanged. But didn't the people of Forsyth make adjustments to it?
Yeah, the judge had ordered that the hanging, as in accordance with state law, had to be private and hidden from view. But there were clearly people in the county who were desperate to turn this into a show. And so the sheriff decided to hold the hanging in a very public place in a pasture that was ringed by hills so that people could kind of spread out their picnic blankets. And they built a fence around it. But the night before the hanging, a mob came and burned the fence to the ground, but they left the scaffold completely intact.
After the hanging, wasn't there another crime that closely resembled what happened to May Crow? Since the black people had left, how did the white residents of Forsyth react? How did they explain it?
Yeah, this was a shocking thing to find in the newspaper archives, and sometimes you don't really know what you're after. I was simply reading along into the days following all of this, and I thought everything had died down. And then suddenly I found reference to a killing that had occurred very near where May Crow was killed, of a prominent, wealthy white farmer who seemed to be in the very similar area, who had been beaten over the head, dragged into the woods, and left to die. And so, in other words, he was murdered in almost precisely the same way as May Crow. At that point, almost the entire black community was gone. And Rob Edwards had been lynched. The two accused boys had been hung. And there was almost no reaction to this. It was as if it hadn't happened, because I think it raised very troubling questions.
How long did the area remain all white? What happened when black people came to town?
For decades, if anyone tried to cross the county line, there were these episodes, and sometimes it would go a long time between them, but there were episodes. I found evidence of episodes in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, where someone crossed the county line, or a white person would move in and bring a black maid or a black servant, and inevitably there were white men would appear and let them know that this was not allowed in the county, and they would be run off.
And then even in the 1970s, there was the case of Miguel Marcelli. Your mother, you were living there at the time. Your mother was a reporter. Did she cover the story?
Yeah, that was in the summer of 1980, and I was 10 years old. And this was one of the moments when I really started to realize that there was something out of the ordinary. It wasn't just the normal racism in Forsyth. Miguel Marcelli was a firefighter from Atlanta who came to a company party, and he had grown up in the Virgin Islands, so he didn't know anything about Forsyth or its history. And he and his girlfriend were leaving the party, having really been gotten really, you know, scary looks and some intimidation from locals. And two locals went in their truck and shot him in the head.
So this is after civil rights legislation, after schools were integrated in most of the country, not in this area?
That's right.
Dangerous to be black in that town?
Absolutely. I mean, Miguel Marcelli learned that it was not just dangerous, it was potentially deadly. He survived, but he had a bullet to the head.
And then there was the Brotherhood March of 1987. Who organized that?
The Brotherhood March in 1987 started with a white resident named Chuck Blackburn who wanted to protest the ongoing enforcement of this ban. It was soon taken up by the King Center in Atlanta, and especially Hosea Williams, who was one of Martin Luther King's real ground generals during the civil rights battles. And they organized a march that my parents participated in and my sister participated in, and it ended up being about 75 protesters, a fairly modest plan to walk into town and simply speak. It was called the Brotherhood March. And they were set upon by a white mob that threw rocks and bottles. Eventually,
This is 1987,
and eventually law enforcement started arresting armed men in the crowd and convinced the protesters that they had to give up this plan, and it was too dangerous.
Is the town even partially integrated today?
It is. Today, Forsyth is a very different place. It looks a lot like any other part of suburban Atlanta. The population swelled from 30,000 to 200,000 today. It's 10% Latino, about 8% Asian, and about 3% African-American.
Well, 3% in the South, that's a very small percentage.
And it's very small when you look at metropolitan Atlanta. There is an African-American man named Daniel Blackman who's running for the state Senate from Forsyth County. He's a candidate for state Senate. So that's kind of an astonishing fact that a black man can run for election in Forsyth today.
Didn't Oprah Winfrey come to the area?
That's right. After the march in 87, Oprah, who was then in only her sixth month, I believe, as a talk show host, came down and she filmed an episode of the Oprah Winfrey Show on the square and tried to get white people to tell her what, you know, how they had come to have this long racial ban.
But I still wonder about how these attitudes persisted so strongly in this area when the rest of the country was changing. Obviously, racism has not ended in the United States, but this place, it seems to have remained institutionalized.
One of the things that Oprah said after her visit was she concluded that she said there are a lot of white people who are afraid in this community. And I think that was one of the mechanisms, because I never really believed that it was a unanimous thing in the white community to support all of this. But even my family, who were progressive and liberal, we learned early on that to speak out against it was to potentially be at risk. So I think some of this was perpetuated through fear and intimidation, not just against blacks, but also against whites who dissented and disagreed with the status quo.
Patrick Phillips is an award-winning poet, translator, professor at Drew University. He was a finalist for the National Book Award for his book Elegy for a Broken Machine. The one we've been discussing is Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America, published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Leonard, thank you very much.